Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition, the now chilly Tuesday edition of The Morning Show with hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine.
Good morning, Phil.
How are you doing today? Have you did you bundle up warm?
Well, it's interesting because I woke up a little gloomy and then the sun came out and you and I got to chatting and now I feel happy again.
I know. Everything's warm and sunny inside here.
It's that winter February. How do we get through it? But today is a little bit nicer.
We relive the adventures of our youth and summer and those who are fortunate to take a winter break.
So true. And
we have one of those in the studio with us this morning. We'll get to more of that.
We do. Weather first, though.
Weather first, which is gloomy, patchy freezing fog, and then a chance of snow with patchy freezing fog tonight. High of 30 degrees today, so it's not even going to break freezing. But tonight, we have the winter weather advisory that the skiers have all been waiting for. Looks like a pretty good chance, 80% to 90% of 1 to 3 inches of new snow down here, and hopefully more up on the ski hill.
I hope so. I was hearing interesting terms about what they were calling the small little pieces of ice and snow that they were skiing over the other day. And
crud.
Yes, that's one term. You don't want to hear the other ones.
Yeah. So it continues on through Wednesday night, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It looks like a little bit of a chance of snow every day with highs that are above freezing, lows below. So it's one of those borderline variable conditions depending on what elevation you're at.
It's certainly been that sort of a winter.
But let's turn our borderline conditions to sunnier tropical climes.
We're lucky today because even though many of us have been here in the kind of mixed weather all winter, we're with someone who's gotten a really nice break.
Yeah, and this person, we'll just come right out with it. It's Ben Olson. You know him as publisher of The Reader, and I think we can say this on the air, degenerate bartender.
That's my other handle, yeah.
Musician, many other things.
But today he's here as one of the crew members of two recently conducted exciting sailing adventures.
In the Caribbean
and crossing the Atlantic. How many people have the opportunity to cross the Atlantic on a sailboat?
That was pretty special, actually. Yeah, I'm lucky to have those two experiences. I think one of them would have been awesome, but I got two great experiences.
Relive them with us this morning, and let's start with the first one. How did your thirst for adventure come about?
Well, I mean, I've always been a traveler. I've always kind of said yes to things. I think that it really broadens your world when you see other cultures and experience other climates and everything. And so I've traditionally always just tried to get out there as much as I could. But with this Atlantic crossing, I've always wanted to cross an ocean or, go around the world in a sailboat. It's, I don't know why. It's just, I've read so many sailing novels and I've just been, inured with the sea. I think I know that I belong out there for some reason. And so it's odd how that Atlantic crossing came up, but I just wrote something in The Reader one day. I think it was the Read, Listen, Watch. I think I was recommending the book 2 Years Before the Mast, which is a great book. And I said, it's always been my dream to cross the ocean or sail around the world. And it was a couple days later, Katie and I, my girlfriend Katie, we were getting ready for a gig, and I got an email from a guy that I knew years ago who said, "Hey, careful what you wish for, dude. I'm crossing the Atlantic a year from now. I'm looking for crew members. Are you interested?" And that's what started the whole thing right there.
Well, you have to say yes to an offer like that, but
yes.
Aside from the wanderlust, the sense of thirst or quest for adventure, did you have much sailing experience? Did you get out at least on Lake Pendre and the Spud Cup?
Yeah, I grew up sailing on this lake. And then in college, my friends and I, we would pack a bunch of us together and we'd go to the British Virgin Islands and we'd bareboat, which is an experience because there's first tier charter companies, there's second tier charter companies, and then there's these third tier, which take all the crap boats that have holes and patches and everything else, but you get them for really cheap. And we went down there right in the middle of hurricane season one time, because that's even cheaper. And we would charter boats down there, and we would sail around the British Virgin Islands, a bunch of college kids. And so I fell in love with that life. And so I had a little sailing experience, but never crossed an ocean or had blue water experience where you were outside of land for days and days. And so that was a whole new world for me, really.
Yeah, and we want to delve or dive into that. And that's, in fact, maybe a good place to jump in. But, I know, too, from some of the writings you've had in the reader, you do have, I guess wanderlust is the best way to describe it, and have combined a lot of the interests you have with some of the trips. And I'm thinking about specifically the foodie trip to Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. that trip came about because Katie and I were looking for cheap airline tickets, and we didn't care where we went. And then I think, I forget who first found it, but we said, oh my gosh, round trip flights to Hanoi right now are $600. And so we just booked it and didn't even think twice. And so like that trip was just one of those random, well, I guess we'll go to Vietnam, you know, because I'd been to Thailand before, and I love Southeast Asia. But I think the general idea is that I feel like when you get an opportunity thrown before you, you have to take it and you have to travel. It's this thing inside me that I need to see and experience other cultures. I think it broadens so much of the way you look at your own country to look at how they do things elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that's important to me.
Yeah. And we started out talking about sort of a definition for you, Ben, as an adventurer, as Phyllis said, wanderlust. Tell us, we've heard about Vietnam and we're about to hear more about the sailing trip, but what other kinds of adventures have you been on? Let's hear about your adventuring and we'll come back to sailing.
My 20s, I didn't really pay rent anywhere in my 20s. I couch surfed. I moved around. I was trying to be a writer, and part of being a writer is gathering experiences and characters. So I would do things like hitchhike a lot. I would just hitchhike around the West. My friend and I hitchhiked through Mexico one time. You get picked up by the most random people. You get kind of just taken right into their world, and you get this amazing keyhole view at who they are and all their strange activities. And then an hour later, 10 minutes later, whatever, they just leave you off, and I would just write who they were down in my notebook.
And I think you've touched on one of the ways of travel that unfortunately a lot of tourists don't take advantage of. They're packed into a 2-week schedule. If it's today, it must be Belgium. We have to see every site, cathedral, yeah, church, versus the extended period of time that's unstructured, unagendized, and you live more close, more simple towards the average people, and you don't know who you're going to meet. And
exactly.
So you meet some of the most amazing people.
I think that's important. I think that the most important part about traveling is ingratiating yourself with the people that you meet along the way. I mean, there were times in Vietnam where we didn't speak. We spoke a little Vietnamese because we tried to learn, but not enough to really get us anywhere. But there were times when we were hanging out with people. One particular time in the town of Hue, this kid, he must have been 19 years old. He had a backpack full of wooden flutes, and we had our instruments with us. And we were just sitting at this little beer bar, sitting on buckets, drinking beer, and I just pulled out my guitar and started playing it, and then Katie brought her ukulele out, and then he brought his flutes out, and we just started playing, and we jammed with this guy, and we didn't speak any common language together, but we played music together for like 3 hours and shut the place down, and it was so much fun, and we didn't have any problem communicating.
That's an incredible story, and following, kind of following this vein of thinking, so some of the most adventurous things that I've been on or friends of mine have shared with me are those that are almost entirely unplanned, unstructured, spontaneous.
Yeah.
And yet there's a level of planning that's needed for other kinds of trips, and that's going to be our segue back into this. You got to set yourself up to be publishing The Reader while you're gone. How did you do that?
Yeah, I'm still getting used to having this whole full-time job thing. As anybody who runs their own business can attest, you never really get that time off. All you do is just move that time a little earlier. And so for the Vietnam trip, I was gone for a month. For the Atlantic crossing, I was gone for nearly 2 months. And, I mean, that's 7-8 issues I missed, which is a lot for – and at the time – I think it was Vietnam. There, I hadn't even hired Lindsay Cabrera yet, so it was just Cameron, who was editor at the time. And so I, worked weekends and nights, and I try to lay out as many issues as I can in advance, you know, write stories that aren't, we call them evergreen stories, so they don't, you know, the leaves don't fall off of them, that you can publish them anytime. And luckily, the community, we have so many contributors that love to send stuff in. I say, hey, you know, open call for submissions, and we just get dozens of cool, interesting articles. And so it was a combination of hard work on my part, but also the community helping out, and because the Reader is a community paper, it's for and by the community. And so it's really cool to be able to open up a little extra, a few extra pages, and give those to the community to write in what they will.
Yes, and I think it did pretty well in Ben's absence.
It did very well. I think the testimony to Ben being gone is that unless you knew Ben was gone, you wouldn't have known Ben
was
gone.
That's right. You have must have a supportive staff, and as you just mentioned, a supportive community. And I noticed the crossword was still coming out every week, so I was happy.
And letters to the editor kept piling in. So
yes, you know, the news business doesn't stop if the publisher goes on vacation.
That's right.
So you've had these experiences that really set you up to be able to plan to be gone. And let's delve into the Atlantic crossing, that first big trip. That sounds like something you'd have to do a lot of extensive planning, or someone would have to do a lot of extensive planning for.
It's not something to take lightly. The Atlantic is, I mean, crossing an ocean is not an easy task by any means. And I, Katie and I both, I mean, we felt trepidation. We were like, you know, what if you get sick? What if you get hurt? What if you have a huge weather that comes up? I mean, you're a thousand plus miles away from land at some points. And so it took, I think more than anything, it took a little mental preparation, to successfully let go and say, I cannot have control over events that are beyond my control. So all I have to do is just monitor myself and, you know, be a good crewmate and do my job on the boat, and, you know, and we'll get through this. And, you know, when we were flying into Madeira, you know, Katie and I went to Portugal and Spain for 2 or 3 weeks to travel before we met up with the boat. And so flying into Madeira, and I see this tiny little sail as I were, you know, coming into the airport. I see this little tiny sail on the horizon, and I think, that's going to be us.
Oh, what a feeling.
We're going to be on that big blue ocean.
Little speck.
Yeah. That's right.
And so, we're going to have to embrace it. And
so tell us a little more about the invite, the captain, the boat, his, her preparation.
Yeah. The captain is, his name is Chris White, and he is a Sandpoint resident. And he, you know, if you've eaten salmon in Sandpoint, you've probably eaten a fish that he's caught wild in Bristol Bay, Alaska. He's fished in Alaska for, you know, years and years and years. I think it might even be 40 years. He's been a fisherman up there.
Must be a comforting thought to have a captain who does that as his everyday job.
Yeah, Chris and I, we met about 10 years prior to this trip. He wrote a book about his experiences fishing in Alaska. And I wrote a book when I was 24, about my hitchhiking experiences. It was about my train traveling experiences around the country. And we, as writers in small towns often do, we, you know, met up, we got to know each other, I just think we're kindred spirits in many ways. I understand him, and he understands me, and we both kind of understand each other's writing. We got to be friends long ago, and and so when he asked if we wanted to join the crew, I thought, what a great opportunity to do this adventure, but also what a great opportunity to get to know him better. Mm-hmm. And when he told me that the other crewmate was going to be Gary Quinn, who I've, you know, met a few times in the past. He was a teacher when I was at the high school. You know, Gary's an engineer. He's a local. And so I had the same reaction with him. I get to meet and know Gary Quinn a little bit more. And so it was really cool to have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And Chris, you know, Chris as a captain is a very confident, capable man. And immediately I realized that we were in good hands mm-hmm. when we got onto his boat. And he's lived on boats all of his life. And that's so comforting to know when you're going out into the abyss.
So there's a lot of questions there that we want to unpack, but let's get some of the basics here. So you met up in Madeira, mm-hmm. Island off the coast of Spain, Portugal.
Yep.
And then where did you go from there? Tell us about the route.
Yeah, so the route was supposed to be Madeira to Antigua, which is in the Windward, or I'm sorry, it's in the Leeward Islands in
and
in
give the Caribbean. Draw us a little map for the listeners. So I think we all have an idea of where Spain is, us about it.
So where the Mediterranean comes out into the Atlantic, that is, you know, obviously between Africa and Europe. So Madeira is a little bit north of where the Mediterranean mm-hmm. comes out. It's about 600 miles west of Portugal. And, you know, there's the Azores, there's Madeira, there's the Canary Islands. Those are all islands kind of on the eastern Atlantic side. Madeira is a common jumping off point. They have this thing called an ARC, A-R-C, Atlantic Relay Crossing, where boats meet together, and, you know, there's like 100 boats that cross the Atlantic together. It's a yearly rally they've had for like 35 years. Sometimes they leave from Madeira, sometimes they leave from the Canaries. But it's a great time to jump right down into the trade winds, which blow east to west quite frequently. And then you kind of just take the trade winds all the way across the Atlantic to Antigua, which, as I said, is about halfway up the Caribbean chain, mm-hmm. you know, halfway between Florida and South America.
So you're first sailing south a good bit to the coast of Africa and then across.
Yes.
You're not going straight line.
Yeah, if you went straight line, you would give up on a lot of those trade winds. So mm-hmm. we actually started out going dead south, and it was odd when we started out because the trade winds blow. They have blown every year for hundreds and hundreds of years. They've taken man across the ocean for so long. So people rely on them. They blow consistently. They blow, you know, anywhere between, you know, 18 and 30 knots is just they just always blow. And so for some reason, when we took off from Madeira, they were not blowing.
Oh, dear.
There was a high pressure bubble or something was going on. And so from Madeira, we were stuck motoring with a jib up, which is the little mm-hmm. sail in the bow of the boat, and we were motoring just to make headway and get into the trade winds for days, 6-7 days.
Wow!
And instead of gently, you know, taking the trades and making our western route, we had to keep going south to keep getting into the trades, and it got to be a little bit of a problem because we were motoring so much that before even making the westward push, we were like down to a quarter tank of diesel.
Wow.
And so we had to make the decision. I mean, I went to bed one night and came up in the morning and realized, oh, our course has changed dramatically. We're going to these islands over here.
In order to get gas.
In order to get diesel enough to make sure that we didn't get caught. Because if we
yes.
could have made it across, but the safety issue is you need the diesel engines to run the fridge and to run yeah. everything. So you need to run a couple hours a day just to keep batteries charged. So like to be stuck in the middle of the Atlantic without any wind, we would have sat there and wallowed and waited for the wind to come.
Which is why you have a responsible captain who can make those kinds of decisions.
Yes. And it was a good decision. You know, it was eight days total that it took us to get to Cape Verde, and I think it would have been a very uncomfortable trip if we didn't fill up with diesel.
I'm imagining you're not carrying all the water you need. You're using some desalination that probably needs power, so you need to have the diesel to run the generators, to kick in the batteries to just have drinking water.
Yeah. He has a desalinator on board, and it takes water right up from the bottom of the boat, but you got to run the engines to run that. Yeah. Some people run with bottles and bottles and bottles of water, but it seems ridiculous. It's expensive to run a desalinator, to put a desalinator in, but it's sustainable and it's easy, and you only have to have 4 or 5 or 6 gallons at any time. It was a decision that we took, and we as a crew, and we said, okay, we're gonna stop here. Cape Verde, you know, Verde means green in Spanish. This island was, I didn't see a green thing on it. It was the dustiest, like, most barren island.
It's an ironic name.
It is a very ironic name.
So were there 100 other ships then? Was you part of this large regatta you were mentioning? Or were you?
Oh, no, we weren't part of the ARC. Oh, okay. Yeah, we were on our own the whole time. We saw maybe 3 boats the whole time we were under sail. And they were cargo ships.
So what was that like, being out at sea, out of the sight of land? It had to be humbling.
It's, you know, honestly, it's a soulful kind of experience. It's not like anything I've ever experienced before. I think that there's a removal from everything that makes noise and everything that, quote unquote, matters. There's a removal from your life, and you're instead, all you worry about is the wind and the water and the sun and what you're going to eat. And everything else is just kind of stripped away. And it's a beautiful sensation. The captain, he told us sailing across an ocean is not for everybody. You know, are you guys comfortable in your own head? Are you comfortable in your own space? Are you comfortable alone? And I've, you know, check for me. Like, I prefer being alone a lot. I love being alone. I get the most done when I'm alone. So for me to, like, turn the phone off, turn the emails off, and not, you know, not be Ben at the Reader anymore for a month, it was bliss to me.
That's a rare treat.
Yeah.
So draw us a quick picture of the boat. How big a boat?
It's a 39-foot catamaran. It's a lagoon catamaran, which means it has 2 pontoons. You know, they have roughly two types of sailboats that people will sail on. One's a monohull, which is the traditional single hull, and then a catamaran is a little bit wider. It doesn't sail quite as fast, and it doesn't keel over to the side like you see boats when they're under sail. So it's a more comfortable ride, and I am glad that we had a cat, because we had more room to roam. There were only 4 of us on board. There's 2 bunks on one side, and then there's 1 bunk on the other side. And so there's plenty of space. And there's, you know, there's a little, it's called the saloon. It's like a little inside seating area with the galley, which is the kitchen. And then you come back on the aft deck, and there's a little seating area in the helm there. And that's your whole world. And, you know, you can go up on the bow, you can go below, you can go in the saloon or the aft deck, but that's it.
Yeah.
This raises so many questions for me, but I want to go back to one just slightly, maybe slightly technical one. Is a catamaran considered a safer boat for a trip like this rather than the monohull, or not really?
You know, safer is a tough word. I believe that they are, because they don't roll as it's really hard to roll a catamaran. It's and also another thing is catamarans don't sink. Monohulls have a lead weight in the keel, which keeps it from rolling. And the keel is, you know, the board that sticks under the water that kind of keeps the boat on its tack. So a monohull, in order to keel over a certain amount, it needs to have weight down there to counteract and to keep the boat upright. So you roll a monohull, it's going to want to gently roll back upright.
Sure.
It's kind of part of why it's built that way. A catamaran, you can put a hole right through the hull and it will fill with water and it will still float. And so I do think a catamaran's safer.
It does sound a little safer. However, growing up in Minnesota, I have tipped over a catamaran and you sure don't want to have to write one of them.
Yeah. Isn't it the preferred vessel for those end of world apocalyptic water world? I'm thinking Kevin Costner in Water World.
He had a trimaran, which was an amazing boat. But yeah, they make some that are amazing designs. They make some that actually do keel over. They come up on an airfoil on one hull, and so you can go to the ends of the earth with what kind of design you want. But I think for our passage, it was ideal, just because it gave us so much more space and it was really comfortable to sail under, you know.
It's stable.
Yeah.
Now we've left the technical field for the moment, and as Ben, as you were describing the experience of being in your head and having the time to yourself, I found myself drawing a connection with long distance hiking. Phil and Ben, I bet you've had talks about that. Phil, yeah, you've been away. Totally.
There are some similarities. Yes, with the long distance hiking, basically you're eating, you're drinking water, or you're sleeping, or walking. You're one of those four. That's it.
Yes.
You're emptying the bin of all the other detritus that makes up life and makes, you know, all the important things in life. And I think there are a lot of similarities. I felt like I was an astronaut on that boat at sometimes. Like, we're on a voyage. We can't get off. We're going to the moon, you know.
Which brings me to another question that's also a bit of a comparison. Phil and Deb, who've done so many long-distance hikes, you're constantly in motion. You're working all day. You're trying to get enough food to eat. And I find myself thinking it may be kind of the opposite on a long sailing trip. You're maybe hoping to get enough exercise. Is that true? Or
at first, it was really tough to find a calisthenic, you know, routine, because you can't go for a walk. And Katie and I both, we love to go for hikes and walks, and it's just something we do. So that was actually the hardest part about this trip. And, you know, if I'm lucky that it was the hardest part. It was the inability to get off the boat and just take a walk. But you find ways around that. I mean, we did jumping jacks and sit-ups and push-ups and little routines. I mean, we had two-hour watches. So we would serve watch for 2 hours and then we'd be off for 6 hours. So, and you did that around the clock. And so you have time. I did it all on my watch when we're on autopilot and we didn't have to steer. I often just hung off the side of the boat and did my little exercises.
So this is a great segue. The listener just texted in a question, probably a follow-up to what you're just saying here. Ray Jardine, I don't know if you know him, a famous adventurer. Has done all the long distance trails and built the CAD design to design the boat that he built to sail across the Atlantic.
Cool.
So, you know, way off the charts in terms of adventure.
Yeah.
But he also wrote in his book that to retain his legs to hike again after spending so much time sailing around the world, he did special exercises. Did you find you had to do some kind of retraining of your legs afterwards, or special exercises during or after?
I was a little less. I didn't have as much stamina as I normally did. But to be honest with you, I think the everyday pitching and rolling of a boat, that actually is really good for your core. And so instead of just sitting and being a resting metabolism, you're always engaging some muscle or some core. And we both lost weight, you know, which is odd because you think you just eating and sitting sailing, you would gain weight. But we both lost weight, and I think it's due to that core exercise.
You're always in motion.
24 hours a day. Even sleeping, you're engaging your core, just trying not to fall out of the bed.
So many other questions. I want to delve into the dynamics, though. It's a very small number of people in a pretty crowded place, less crowded than some.
Yeah.
How did that go?
You know, it went absolutely great. I think that this trip could have been a nightmare if it was with the wrong crew. I think any long distance, small, you know, close quarters trip can be tough if you don't enjoy the people that you're with. Chris is a very spiritual, soulful, knowledgeable man who kind of teaches you by throwing you in the water.
You know? Well, not literally, right?
Not literally, okay. But, you know, it's like, it was very fun because, you know, the first couple of nights of sailing, he's like, okay, and then if we start luffing up or the wind starts going, just take the foresail down. And we're like, well, we don't know how to do that. And he's like, oh, you'll figure it out. And so at first it was a common joke, but then I was like, no, that's the way he teaches. It's like, just do it. And if you can't figure it out, come get him. And I got to really appreciate that because, A, he trusted us enough not to ruin the boat. But B, I think that's kind of how my dad used to teach. It was very experience-based. Do it. And if you screw it up, I will help you figure it out from there.
Now, the winds are blowing 24 hours a day. You're sailing through the night. Somebody's got to be up watching the boat at night. You're taking shifts.
Yeah.
And so it's an arduous thing. And really, with four people, you're probably spending time alone running the vessel or sleeping. So you're interacting less maybe than many people think.
Yeah. You know, honestly, on our watch schedule, I thought that it was a beautiful schedule. It was a beautiful way to live. You are at the helm for 2 hours, and then you have 6 hours off. So, you know, let's say you sleep for 3 hours, and then you're up. You're obviously, when there's an event happening, whether we're changing sail or dinner or something, everybody's up and we're all helping. But there are so many hours of the day when we had them to ourselves. And when you're with a comfortable group of people, you can be by yourself right next to somebody. And, you know, Gary liked to braid leather, rawhide strips, and he braided a bunch of bracelets. And I had a, you know, we all had crossing bracelets that he braided for us. And we learned celestial navigation, you know, with sextants. Or I should say we tried to learn it. The math was crazy. Katie and I had our musical instruments. You know, we all had things to occupy our time. But that's the thing about being with people that you're comfortable with, is we were able to shut off completely and be by ourselves, quote unquote. And there wasn't any pressure to small talk, and there wasn't any, like, you know, we talked about everything and we talked about nothing. And I really appreciated that about this crew. We all got along really well, did really well in each other's space. And I think we all had a genuine respect for each other.
It sounds like that would be key. And having known your friends before must have made a difference. I can imagine how different the trip would be if it were four strangers that hadn't really understood one another.
More way more risky.
Yes.
The closest analogy that I've experienced actually isn't our long-distance hiking. Deb and I paddled a two-person kayak down the Yukon River about 20 years ago. Two-person kayak, exactly 32 inches apart, all day, every day. So
you get to know somebody pretty well.
You get to know somebody really well.
Yes, it's true.
But with that, we're going to take a short music break here. Let Ben regroup his thoughts and talk about his next sailing adventure when we come back. For right now, we're going to play a little Jimmy Buffett. Daydreaming. I think he meant the island, not the cigar.
I hope so.
Yeah.
He was just in, well, he wasn't, but the Parrothead
Tribute Band
show,
was.
Yes, was just in Spokane.
If you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And if you missed part of the first interview, you're going to want to be sure to check out the podcast on this one. Go to KRFY.org later on today, and you can hear all about Ben's tales of crossing the Atlantic.
So true. I'll be loading it right after the program this morning. So if you've missed part of it, you can get back there. Anyway, we are joined this morning by a man of many hats. It's Ben Olson, known as the editor, owner of The Reader magazine in Sandpoint, but he's also a singer. I think you're an actor too, aren't you, Ben? A lot of things go
I have acted in one very poor movie, yes.
But, so, but you
wrote the movie, or you wrote a stage play. I've seen
I helped write, yeah, I wrote plays, but I helped write this movie, this student movie one time, and they made me act in it. But,
oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't normally call myself an actor.
All right, but a writer and many other things. But most recently, you've been a sailor, and prior to the break, we were talking about your Atlantic crossing, which happened last year, and we're planning to go on and talk about your most recent trip on the Caribbean, but during break, we were talking about scary moments, if any happened. Who hasn't had an idea or a scary moment at sea? So
yeah,
let's go to that before we move on to the Caribbean.
Yeah, so we did have a few scary moments on the Atlantic crossing. You know, once the wind, the trade winds came back, we really got to our stride. And, you know, most of the time you're moving at about a jogger's pace, which is a slow way to move 3,000 miles. But every once in a while, the wind will pick up. And there were a few times when we were, you know, 25, 30 knot winds, which is a lot on the ocean. And, you know, we're moving pretty good. We're moving about 8 or 9 knots max. And the waves, when they come at you, they're like two-story buildings. I mean, they're 25-footers sometimes. And they're coming at you from behind. So you're just sitting on the after deck, and you're watching these waves, and the horizon disappears. And the wave, you know, grows and grows and grows. And, you know, you're kind of opening your mouth to almost to say, like, do we need to be and then the boat just kind of lifts right up it, and you just, and so, you know, it's scary. And the captain came up to me and said, you know, don't fall off right now.
Good advice.
It's
gonna be really hard to get you in this.
So do you click yourself in with a cable system of some kind?
You know, there are cables to clip into the railing. Monohulls use those a lot because they keel over quite a bit, sometimes 45 degrees. Catamarans are flat mostly, so you don't generally need to clip in unless it's really bad weather. So we didn't have to clip in at all on this trip. But at night when we were on watch, you know, sometimes you couldn't even see the water off the side of the boat. It was so dark. And so we wore these things called, it was just called a necklace. When it reacts to salt water, it'll send off an alarm. And it was an odd thing. Katie and I, you know, I took over her watch all the time. So I was giving her a hug and saying, you know, have a good sleep. And we were both so salty that it set off this necklace. And, you know, we heard the alarm and we go inside and it's just going off and blaring and blaring. And I'm just looking around and nobody heard it.
Oh, dear.
And so, you know, we hooked it up to a speaker after that because, you know, if at night.
If something did happen, yeah, you'd want people to hear that.
Morbid thoughts at night where you think, God, I could just jump right off of here and nobody would ever see me again. So it's scary like that because everybody else is sleeping.
Those are the thoughts in your head that you were asked about before you started.
Do you hear voices? Yes. Well, we've talked about scary weather. Did you have any interactions with animals, birds, anything like that?
The dolphins were so amazing on this trip. Dolphins, they're just curious and they love to play and they love swimming right before the bow. I think there's a pressure that kind of eases them along when they swim right before a bow of a boat, and they like sailboats more than power boats. So I'd say every 2 days we would have a pod of dolphins just come and swim with us. And sometimes there were hundreds of them. Sometimes they were jumping in the air 15 feet. And they were so much fun. And so every time you'd see dolphins, everybody, oh, dolphins, port bow. And everybody would come up and we'd just sit there and watch dolphins for half an hour. And there was nothing better to do in the world.
It sounds like an absolutely fabulous adventure. Tell us what it was like stepping back onto dry land and then coming home to North Idaho.
Yeah, it was tough, honestly. When we first saw lights coming into Antigua after 25 days of, you know, nothing but the horizon, it was a mixed feeling. I actually felt very sad because I had found a purpose and a way to live on this boat, and I didn't want to come back. I just, if he would have said, well, let's just keep going around the horn and go to the Galapagos or whatever, I would say, oh, okay, I'm in. I took to this type of life immediately, and it was really hard to step onto land and realize, okay, that whole thing is over. Because it made sense to me that simplicity, the danger, just the connection with this entity, this ocean, which can kill you, it can nurture you, it can save you, it can do everything to you, and you have no control over it but to just throw up a sail and take that wind power to move. But there's an acceptance when you're on the ocean for many days, and I loved accepting the fact that I could die, I could come through successful, and I don't care either way, because all I really cared about that moment was just enjoying the experience. And so it was hard. I remember sitting on the bow, you know, with tears in my eyes as I saw the land, and I just did not want to get off the boat.
Yes, I can imagine it.
And transition points are hard.
I was connecting that with long hikes too. Yeah. Same sort of thing. Hard to transition.
End of my first hike, all I wanted to do was turn around and walk south. If it wasn't for the fact that winter was on its way and I was out of money, I probably would have.
Yeah. But,
so did you have a plane you had to meet? Were you on schedule on time? Or
we missed our plane. Yeah. The low weather or the low wind event that happened in the beginning of the trip messed up our time schedule. So we actually were supposed to fly, I think it was on the 23rd of December, and we actually landed on Christmas Eve night, the 24th. And
so close.
Yeah, we missed it by a day. You know, and it only cost us a little bit of money to reschedule. And then we got 2 extra days in Antigua, which was great. And so, you know, it's hard to plan for air travel when you're in the middle of the ocean. You don't have a whole lot of connection to land.
Yeah.
We do have this little satellite device that you could send texts over the satellite thing. So there was a connection to land, but it was not limited. An easy way. Yeah, very limited.
So let's shift to the Caribbean. It sounds like you enjoyed the adventure so much you found a way to do something like it again. Is that how it happened?
Well, you know, the captain, Chris, he took the boat down to Grenada after our voyage. He went with his family and did a couple of separate sails through the Caribbean. And we, you know, we just had no idea that what was happening or what he was doing or anything. And he just kind of emailed a few months before, I think it was at some point in summer, he just emailed and said, "Hey, I'm going from the Grenada to Florida eventually." Mm-hmm. And I was looking for crewmates for any portion of that. And I had a lot of fun with you guys. Would you like to come back? And it was a perfect timing because we were actually planning another trip. We were close to buying plane tickets, and then we both kind of looked at each other and said, okay, let's go sailing again. And so we canceled our trip and booked airfare down to Grenada and made it happen again.
All right. And for those who maybe wouldn't know where Grenada is, draw us another picture for this trip.
Yeah, so the Caribbean islands, if you go from, you know, South America to Florida, the Caribbean islands are kind of a little bowed. The ones on the southern part are called the Windward Islands because they're more toward the trade winds. And then the islands right about Dominica, they start to kind of move to the west a little bit, kind of like a boomerang. And those are called the Leeward Islands because they're away from the wind. And so the Grenada is just right up from South America. It's about 12 or 11 degrees latitude. It's safely out of the hurricane belt, so a lot of people store their boats there. They do get weather. They have gotten a hurricane there. I think 2004 they had one. But it's very rare they get hit by a hurricane. So it's a good hurricane season boat storage for people. And that's what he did. He dry docked his boat. So we started there and then made a general push north along the island chain. And, you know, it was the Atlantic crossing took about 3,200 miles. This was a little bit different trip. It was 650 miles total. And instead of spending, you know, instead of stepping on the boat and not stepping off for a month, we were island hopping. We were getting off the boat. Every day we were swimming. You know, we never swam on the Atlantic crossing. Yeah.
The water's a little warmer when you were there.
So it was the same boat, the same captain, but a completely different trip.
So what was it had to be an interesting cross-cultural experience. So many of those islands have unique histories from their native populations, and then various different European cultures have settled each one of them.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see how resilient these islands are. They have been conquered and fought over for so many years. They have been ravaged by hurricanes and by weather events, and still there's this joy that we saw on every island that I don't understand how people can be so happy and complacent with their lives when it seems like everything is turned upside down every couple of years. And I think maybe that might have something to do with it. It's like, it's that easy mentality is like, well, I have everything that I need. I have all the food that I need growing on my trees. I have a roof over my head. And when it gets taken, I will build it again. Mm-hmm. And there's something beautiful about that. And I feel sorry for a lot of the local inhabitants of islands that have to deal with hurricanes and you know, conquering world powers, but I also I think that they've got something figured out. And so each island had its own culture and each island had its own thing going on, and some were better than others, some were friendlier than others, but I saw across the board, I saw that everybody that we met, at least, treated us well and with respect, and genuinely seem to enjoy our presence.
Was there a favorite island or a favorite experience, an anecdote from one of them you'd like to share?
You know, the islands change as you get north, further north. I really enjoyed the Grenadines, which, you know, Grenada, when you go north of Grenada, there's just a big collection of islands there, and then there's St. Vincent. So they call it St. Vincent and the Grenadines. The Grenadines are, you know, you picture that classic green ocean water and, you know, the little island with the white sand and one tree and things like that. I mean, that's the Grenadines. They are filled with these beautiful little islands, and we would swim with turtles. You know, we went to lobster cooks on the beach. You know, there was just this carefree, fun nature. We camped at an island that was maybe 50 yards long by like 10 feet wide. It's like this tiny little island. Yeah. And, you know, you jump off the boat and swim to shore and grab some coconuts and swim back on the boat. I mean, it was a really beautiful way to be. And there are other yachts, but honestly, I never noticed or cared if anybody was anchored next to us.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question, since your captain is a fisherman and you all may know that I fish a bit. Was there fishing on this trip?
We fished a lot in the Atlantic, and we caught a lot of fish. You know, we caught tunies. We caught some Dorado, which, my. But they slipped off the hook. And we fished almost every day in the Caribbean and did not catch a thing. until almost the very end of the trip, we're making the passage over from Anguilla, which is north of St. Martin, kind of almost to the Virgin Islands. There's an 80-mile passage, which is a substantial passage, from Anguilla to the British Virgin Islands, to Virgin Gorda. And we're just starting out on that 12, 13-hour passage. And I'm at the helm, and I see all these birds are diving off to the starboard bow. And I think there could be a whale there. Oh, my God, I've never seen a whale in the wild. And up close, at least. And then I thought, oh, that's a school of fish. That, obviously, they're feeding off of whatever. And so then I look back, and the pole just goes, man, bends over. And I jumped off the helm. Chris took the helm. I strapped in the belt, and immediately I took this line, and I saw the line go out like 100 feet. I mean, this fish just had so much power, and it was bigger than anything we ever caught on the Atlantic crossing. And 10 minutes later, you know, we wrestled it closer, and, you know, we finally start to see it, and it's just this enormous skipjack tuna, and it had to have weighed 25 pounds. I mean, this thing, looking at it head on, was just, it was like the size of, it was a swollen football of a fish that was like 3 feet long. I mean, it's beautiful.
Are you sure you're not just re-channelizing something from Ernest Hemingway?
I was
the young man in the sea.
I'm not much of a fisherman, so when I tell a fish story, I actually tell the truth about how big it was. But yeah, that fish fed us, a crew of five at the time, that fish fed us three meals each.
Wow.
15 meals out of that fish.
So five. So on this trip, you and Katie and Chris, and who were the other two?
So Chris, his son Taran, mm-hmm. Who was also a fisherman. He's a very accomplished fisherman in Bristol Bay. And then Taran's, I don't know if they're fiancés. Yeah, they're fiancés now. Kara. And okay. So it was Taran and Kara, Katie and I, and Chris and his friend for the first 10 days or so. And then Taran and Kara got off in Antigua. And then Dan and Kate Huseman joined. Mm-hmm. Kate's a writer in the area. And Dan does Outward Bound. And they're both Sandpointians.
So it sounds like a real party boat.
It was fun. You know, we didn't miss any cocktail hours.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes, and then we're going to take a song break, and we've run out of time for community calendar. So, but let's delve into the last few minutes. Lessons learned, common things from both trips, tie them together for us.
I think for the most part, I will go back to kind of what I started with, which was it's important to understand and embrace your own culture. And in order to do that successfully, I do think that you need to get out of your own culture and see how other people live around the world, whether they're living better than you or not as well as you, or you know, I just think that it's part of the human experience to understand how others live and how they embrace life. And to me, I cannot feel like I'm part of a community unless I know what is outside of the community. You know, it's kind of like that Nietzschean idea of, you know, you need to know dark to understand light, and you need to you need to understand that. I feel like every time that I go away from Sandpoint, and even if I experience something beautiful and amazing and that opens my eyes, I still realize that there is a love that I have for this community and for this place, and it strengthens that, you know, because I can cross an ocean, but I realize that what I really was crossing for was to find that I enjoy myself here more at home. I can get rid of the wanderlust and the itch for just a little bit, and see the world and experience the world, and then come back and be comfortable in my place, which is Sandpoint.
Wherever we go, there we are.
Yeah. So very well put.
What's next for Ben?
Yeah, we've noticed you've kind of done the eastern side, bottom side of the Bermuda Triangle. You got cut across the top now?
I don't know. I'm always down for a sailing trip. So as long as Chris has the boat, he knows he can call us for a trip.
Sounds like a little bit of a wish for an invitation.
Sounds like he's fishing, like with the reader column. Yeah.
He can invite me too, Ben, by the way, if he'd like to.
Yeah, we always have an adventure plan. We try to get away once a year just to do something, and who knows what the next one is. We're still contemplating at this point.
Yeah, I would say if there is a lesson learned, it might be wait until the last minute. Things pop up unexpectedly.
It would have been a shame if I had a plane ticket booked. You know, we were going to go to Albania, of all places, and that's an expensive plane ticket. And if I had that ticket booked, there would have been a no for this Caribbean trip, and that would have broken my heart. Well,
what a great way to conclude. Ben Olson of the Sandpoint Reader, I want to thank you for joining us here on KRFY this morning and sharing two really incredible experiences with the listeners.
Yeah, and we need a radio show for next year, so have another adventure next winter.
I'll do my best.
Talk about, yeah.
Now, so, thanks for being interested. Yeah.
So we have just enough time to talk about some upcoming morning shows. We, of course, if you're a fan of the morning show, tune in on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. for Susie Perez and host Susie Perez and Chris Bessler. Tomorrow, their guests will be City of Sandpoint Mayor Shelby Ronstadt and the City Administrator Jennifer Stapleton, who are going to be talking about all things Sandpoint. Then on Thursday, we have Jack and Carrie on as hosts, and they're going to interview Hannah Combs, Executive Director of Pondere Arts Council, about upcoming First Friday. It's a First Friday this Friday. So there's your community calendar.
There it is.
And next Tuesday, you can join Julie and I. We're going to be joined by Kara Satara from Idaho Department of Fish and Game, who's going to be talking about wildlife studies that are ongoing and wildlife management issues and a whole raft of different things. Notice that raft analogy.
Nice pun.
Yes, nice pun. we're gonna go out with a little bit of early Jackson Browne, one of his, I think, the very first song he shopped around for his first album, which seems fitting for today.